Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 632, Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This is being recorded on March 30th of the year 2008. And as indicated, we're going to plunge right in and begin discussing September 11th and Related Matters. I can only encourage members of the listening audience who might be newer to these programs or listeners who might find some of the references here perplexing or at least incomprehensible past a point, to use the websites, www.spitfirelist.com, the FTR supplemental sections, the blog sphere, the websites maintained by sister station WFMU. There's a fellow or gal, as the case might be, who has put all of the For the Record shows on MP3. So there is an awful lot of information on the web from which one can choose. And please do pursue many of these points of information. Use the printed descriptions in particular on the broadcast. And if people want some historical references to what a fifth column is, well, we've got a whole mini library of anti-fascist books in the 30s, 40s, and 50s available for download for free. So please avail yourselves of those. If you want to know what a fifth column is, it's not a reference to classical architecture, but rather the work of fifth columns actually brings buildings down in the most literal sense of the word, be it the House of State or literal buildings in the case of September 11th, obviously, some of the World Trade Center buildings. Now, in discussing September 11th, and related matters, there is no matter more related to September 11th than the issue of oil, and beyond that, the political control, the political power that stems not only from possessing and producing oil, but also from reinvesting the tremendous profits that come from producing or distributing oil, and then reinvesting those profits in corporations, in media outlets, and using that investment to not only increase one's wealth, but also to increase one's power. And so that is a concatenation that is very much at the core of not only September 11th, why the attacks happened, why they were allowed to happen, why we're not hearing about some very important aspects of why they happened and what has come out of that. As one hears about September 11th, as one hears about related matters, war obviously in Iraq, war in Afghanistan and perhaps neighboring Pakistan, as one hears about the threat of war in Iran, as one hears about the threat of war, including nuclear war in the Middle East, watch what happens to the price of oil by the war. The threat of war, the threat of weapons of mass destruction, either real or illusory, up goes the price of oil. And as the price of oil goes up, up go the profits and the resulting power of elements associated with the petroleum industry, meaning the big oil companies, the big oil-producing countries, including Saudi Arabia and the other Middle Eastern kingdoms and countries, including Iran, also Russia and other former Soviet republics, other countries as well, also the big oil companies, also elements such as the Bush family, elements such as the Cheneys, elements such as James Baker, whose think tank at Rice University produced a study that was the first serious suggestion that perhaps Iraqi oil was the answer to America's, quote, energy crisis, unquote, which was created in part by some of the same elements. And those elements, surprisingly enough, the petroleum industry, the politicians associated with it, and the countries and the corporations associated with it, are the beneficiaries of the war itself, wars that they help to produce and wars from which they profit. But it's not like they're doing it alone. A lot of people have been helping them out, and that includes the NASCAR dads and the soccer moms who want little Dakota to ride from her soccer game in perfect security, or at least, well, if a sport utility vehicle or a sport futility vehicle, as I call them, could be said to constitute perfect security, well, Dakota is absolutely sitting pretty. If not, well, not so much, as they say. An article that really goes to the core of one of the central dynamics, one that's so obvious and so central to the issue of the Middle East, September 11th and related matters, that at times I think the most fundamental aspect of it is illusory, or at least escapes people. It's elusive, I should say. And again, that is that it is the war itself. Forget about who's zinging who, or who's threatening to zing who, or who is being rumored to getting ready to zing somebody else, particularly with weapons of mass destruction. Watch what happens to the price of oil. Watch what happens to profits, okay? And watch in particular this particular article from November 10th of 2007, last year. This is an article by Stephen Mufson. It's titled, Oil Price Rise Causes Global Shift in Wealth. And dovetail this with a couple of broadcasts, for the record, 560 and 561, Economics 911. I'll be supplementing those in future broadcasts. High oil prices are fueling one of the biggest transfers of wealth in history. Oil consumers are paying $4 to $5 billion more for crude oil every day than they did just 5 years ago, pumping more than $2 trillion into the coffers of oil companies and oil-producing nations this year alone. The consequences are evident in mines and in mortar. Anger at Chinese motor fuel pumps and inflated confidence in the Kremlin. New weapons in Chad and new petrochemical plants in Saudi Arabia. No driving campaigns in South Korea and bigger sales for Toyota hybrid cars. A fiscal burden in Senegal and a bonanza in Brazil. In Burma, recent demonstrations were triggered by a government decision to raise fuel prices. We didn't hear about that in this country, did we? We just heard about the monks and so forth. We didn't hear about the fact that it was high fuel prices that caused the rioting. Interesting. Continuing with this article from the Washington Post of 11-10-07, in the United States, the rising bill for imported petroleum lowers already anemic consumer savings rates, adds to inflation, worsens the trade deficit, undermines the dollar, and makes it more difficult for the Federal Reserve to balance its competing goals of fighting inflation and sustaining growth. High prices have given a boost to oil-rich Alaska, which in September raised the annual oil dividend paid to every man, woman, and child living there to $1,654, an increase of $547 from last year. In other states, high prices create greater incentives for pursuing non-oil energy projects that might once have looked too expensive and hurt earnings at energy-intensive companies like airlines and chemical makers. Even Kellogg cited higher energy costs as a drag on its third quarter earnings. I guess they didn't put a tiger in their tank, eh? Excuse me. Continuing, with crude oil prices nearing $100 a barrel, there is no end in sight to the redistribution of more than 1% of the world's gross domestic product. Earlier oil shocks generated giant shifts in wealth and pools of petrodollars, but they eventually faded and economies adjusted. This new point in petroleum prices has arrived over 4 years, and many believe it will represent a new plateau even if prices drop back somewhat in coming months. Quote, there's never been anything like this on a sustained basis the way we've seen the last couple of years, unquote, said Kenneth Rogoff, a Harvard University economics professor and former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Oil prices, quote, are not spiking, they're just rising, unquote, he added. The benefits, to the tune of $700 billion a year, are flowing to the world's oil-exporting countries. Two of those nations, Iran and Venezuela, may be better able to defy the Bush administration because of swelling oil revenue. Venezuela has used its oil wealth to dispense patronage around South America, vying for influence even with longtime U.S. allies. And Iran could be less vulnerable to sanctions designed to pressure it into giving up its nuclear program or opening it up to inspection. The world's biggest oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, is using its rejuvenated oil riches to build four cities. Projects like these are designed to burnish the country's image, develop a non-oil economy, and generate enough employment to maintain social stability. And among the things that has been an outgrowth of the rise in petroleum prices, again, is the ability, the capability for many of the oil-producing nations to invest in and influence the economies and political landscapes of other countries. I've spoken in the past about some of the Saudi investment, not only in the financial industry in this country, but in particular in the media. With the huge increase in petroleum prices and with the greater capital now flowing to oil-producing countries and also the petroleum companies and the fossil fuel industry in general, the ability to affect political control, both through direct ownership and also through investment policy and through the use and the strategic use of advertising revenues, is going to increase their ability to control matters political. Recall that in, among other programs, the expanded description to For the Record 305, we took a look at the fact that owning one of the principal stockholders in Standard Oil and one of the driving forces in the petroleum industry is the Underground Reich, using, among other things, the cartel connection stretching from IG Farben to the various Standard Oil companies dating back to the period between the two world wars, cartel agreements that have been manifesting themselves recently in some of the revivals of the hydrogenation process to develop fossil fuels from coal, among other elements. One of the things, too, to keep in mind that about the increase in petroleum prices and the resulting transfer of wealth is that with the U.S. economy tanking, forgive the pun under the circumstances, it gives the oil-producing countries, into whose tank, so to speak, where the money is flowing, a tremendous ability to decide who sinks and who swims on these very, very, very troubled and oiled waters. The following is from the Financial Times of London, from their February 7, 2008 issue. It's an article by Gillian Tett, or an op-ed column by Gillian Tett, titled "Insight: Western Banks Face Sovereign Wealth Fund Backlash." Now, sovereign wealth funds are national funds that are being utilized by, among other countries, and in particular by oil-producing countries, to invest the oil wealth coming into those countries in a nationally productive and a profitable fashion. And one of the things, obviously, that those funds and a deteriorating American financial landscape mean is that basically, if American institutions, public and private, want to get some of that oil wealth into their tanks, so to speak, they better be ready to make whatever concessions are necessary in order to bring that about. This article, again, is by Gillian Tett. "Insight: Western Banks Face Sovereign Wealth Fund Backlash," Financial Times of February 7th of 2008. This column reads in part, "Earlier this week, I chatted with a jet-lagged senior U.S. financier. Like many of his ilk, he is flitting around the Middle East and Asia trying to extract finance from sovereign wealth funds and other investment groups. His latest travels have delivered a surprise. Some funds are quietly getting cold feet about the idea of putting more capital directly into Western banks," he says. "There is a backlash building," unquote, he muttered into a crackling cell phone. "This is striking stuff. In recent months, many equity investors have taken comfort from the idea that sovereign wealth funds could ride to the rescue of Wall Street, if not the City of London as well. For as the subprime scourge has spread, U.S. policymakers have lent on the largest U.S. banks to raise capital almost at any cost. Consequently, they have passed the begging bowl around the sovereign wealth funds with considerable success. Thus far, some $40 to $60 billion worth of injections have been promised to groups such as Merrill Lynch and Citibank, or Citigroup, depending on how you measure the promises. But having stepped into the breach so visibly late last year, some funds are now getting jitters. In China, for example, there are rising complaints that funds are foolish to shovel cash directly into risk-laden U.S. banks when they could be using it in better ways, such as purchasing Western commodity or manufacturing groups. The Chinese are worried they are turning into the source of dumb money, unquote, says one well-placed Asian financier who partly blames the trend on the Blackstone saga, which produced significant paper losses for the Chinese investors. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, the latest round of Federal Reserve interest rate cuts has created unease. For sure, some powerful Gulf investors have been heartened to see that the U.S. authorities are acting in a resolute way. They are doubly relieved that the dollar has held up so well so far. But the dramatic scale of Fed cuts has prompted concern that Wall Street is still sitting on a putrid mess, contrary to what the U.S. banks told the sovereign wealth funds late last year. Unsurprisingly, this leaves Gulf investors cynical about promises from Wall Street banks. It also has some Asian and Gulf funds concluding that if they are going to invest to take advantage of the subprime mess, they are foolish to do so directly or alone. Hence, some are now turning to private equity banks such as J.C. Flowers, which are at least trained to analyze the subprime mess. Now, it would be nice to think this sentiment shift does not matter too much for the U.S. banks. After all, the recent infusion of funds means the largest Wall Street groups are looking pretty well capitalized on paper. It also means they should be able to absorb subprime losses, which banks such as Goldman Sachs think could reach $200 billion for the banks soon. However, the problem is that subprime is just one of several potential looming shocks. Defaults on other forms of consumer debt and commercial property could rise this year. So could defaults on corporate leveraged loans from 2009 on. Meanwhile, the monoline insurers are threatening to blast another hole in banks' balance sheets. Indeed, if you tote up all the hits that could emerge in the next couple of years, it's easy to reach a sum of $500 billion or far more. This is sizable given that Goldman Sachs calculates that the bank's capital is around $1.1600 billion. I would bet that in the coming weeks, large Western banks will once again start passing the begging bowls around the Middle East and Asia. But I would also bet that these banks will find the going increasingly tough. Yes, U.S. political pressure might produce a bit more money for banks. The Gulf and Asia remain flush with cash. But if the sovereign wealth fund money is now flowing to private equity funds instead of Western banks, this gives this tale a whole new twist. Stand by to see a new chapter unfold in this financial crunch. Well, yes, indeed, and as we're going to see, too, that one of the things that is produced by some of this is the possibility that companies that produce very sensitive technology could ultimately be purchased by some of these, or at least have parts of the company or all of the company purchased by some of these sovereign wealth funds. I would note that Abu Dhabi has purchased a nice chunk of American Micro Devices, and AMD is a company that produces a lot of very, very sensitive technologies, ones which, if utilized in an improper fashion, could be very destructive to this or other countries. One of the things that I've noted in connection with Operation Green Quest, one of the things that I've noted in connection with September 11th, and that is the fact that among the elements that were obscured by the deep sixing of the investigation into Operation Green Quest was the P-TECH company. In weeks to come, we're going to take a look at the exoneration, at least for the time being, of Yassin Al-Qadi. He's a Saudi sheikh who was one of the principal investors in P-TECH. He also was one of the people who helped to support Osama bin Laden's activities. And he has recently been exonerated of any terrorist involvement. I would note that the investigation into P-TECH has been deep-sixed, and it's certainly eclipsed with the deep-sixing, or at least the enormous frustration of Operation Green Quest. That's unfortunate because of what it reveals is that the very important P-TECH high-tech company has basically been producing the threat assessment software architecture for the Air Force, the FAA, NORAD, the Department of Energy, which oversees nuclear power plants and other atomic institutions, and has been basically developing the software for other sensitive government agencies as well. And that is a company with massive links to the Muslim Brotherhood and to people and institutions deeply involved, not only in financing terrorism, but institutions connected to the milieu of the targets of the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids. Those raids revealed links between elements of the Bush administration, elements of the GOP right-wing establishment, and elements associated not only with the Muslim Brotherhood, but with the financing of Al-Qaeda, and through people like Youssef Nader, Ahmed Huber, and the late François Genoux, to the underground Reich itself. The Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002 followed investigations by civilians like Rita Katz and actions by people like John Loftus, who filed the lawsuit against Samuel Arian. And unfortunately, the targets of Operation Green Quest, including people connected to the Bush administration, people like Talat Otman, a good friend and political ally of the current George Bush, a fellow who was a director of Harkin Energy, one of George W. Bush's oil companies, and a man who interceded on behalf of the targets of the March 20th, 2002 raids, including PTEC director Yaqub Mirza. He founded many of those institutions. He was not a target of those raids. He's very close to Talat Otman, very close to George Bush, and has escaped indictment. However, a lot of heat did come down as a result of the operation of the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids. Time permitting on this side, and if not the other side, we're going to review some information about what happened to Rita Katz and the other people who helped to bring about the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids. Rita Katz basically had the FBI and the CIA spying on and generally kind of harassing her, an experience shared by other members, other people, including John Loftus, who had been targets of, who had been the people who had helped to bring about those raids. They quickly became a target of investigation. Rita Katz once again has been actively frustrated as a result of U.S. government and interference. Rita Katz's SITE organization, S-I-T-E, had basically found a way of penetrating Islamist websites, including Islamist web operations connected with Al-Qaeda, and after disclosing to the Bush administration and elements of the intelligence community the forthcoming disclosure of another Al-Qaeda video, the public disclosure by the Bush administration or elements associated with it helped to basically blow this connection. For at least the second time, Rita Katz and the SITE organization have been frustrated in a very fundamental way in their efforts against Al-Qaeda and related Islamist elements. They've been frustrated by elements of the Bush administration or allies of the Bush administration. The following is also a Washington Post article, this from October 9th of 2007. It's by Joby Warwick. It's headlined, "Leaks Severed a Link to Al-Qaeda's Secrets." Subheaded, "Firm Says Administration's Handling of Video Ruined Its Spying Efforts." It's about another betrayal of Rita Katz, just like what we spoke about in her book and in accessing excerpts of her book, Terrorist Hunter. This reads in part, "A small private intelligence company that monitors Islamic terrorist groups obtained a new Osama bin Laden video ahead of its official release last month, and around 10 a.m. on September 7th, it notified the Bush administration of its secret acquisition. It gave two senior officials access on the condition that the officials not reveal that they had it until the Al-Qaeda release. Within 20 minutes, a range of intelligence agencies had begun downloading it from the company's website. By mid-afternoon that day, the video and a transcript of its audio track had been leaked from within the Bush administration to cable television news and broadcast worldwide. The founder of the company, the Site Intelligence Group, says this premature disclosure tipped Al-Qaeda to a security breach and destroyed a years-long surveillance operation that the company has used to intercept and pass along secret messages, videos, and advance warnings of suicide bombings from the terrorist group's communications network. Quote, techniques that took years to develop are now ineffective and worthless, unquote, said Rita Katz, the firm's 44-year-old founder, who has garnered wide attention by publicizing statements and videos from extremist chat rooms and websites while attracting controversy over the secrecy of Site's methodology. Her firm provides intelligence about terrorist groups to a wide range of paying clients, including private firms and military and intelligence agencies from the United States and several other countries. The precise source of the leak remains unknown. Government officials declined to be interviewed about the circumstances on the record, but they did not challenge Katz's version of events. They also said the incident had no effect on U.S. intelligence gathering efforts and did not diminish the government's ability to anticipate attacks. And that, of course, is their opinion. Let's review what happened to Rita Katz after Rita Katz and people like John Loftus not only helped to, but basically generated the investigation that uncovered the SAR network, the SAFA Trust, and that resulted in the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002. A couple of subjects, and Rita Katz, in her book Terrorist Hunter, that we've used in, among other broadcasts, For the Record 569, writes about these raids. A couple of weeks later, on March 20th, 2002, I returned from a meeting out of the office to discover a pile of messages from journalists lying on my desk. I called the top one on the pile. So what do you make of these raids in Virginia? The reporter asked. What are you talking about? I guessed what he was referring to, but I wanted to make sure. Early this morning, he told me, about 150 agents from the FBI, police, customs, and INS raided 16 locations in Virginia and some poultry factory in Georgia. Haven't you heard? It's all over the news. So GreenQuest and other agents had raided 18 different locations in Virginia tied to the SAR network. It was the largest counterterrorism raid ever in U.S. history. And some 100 computer companies were subpoenaed as well in connection with these raids. And going on with Rita Katz's experience, who do you think the FBI and the CIA came down on? Yet the FBI wasn't the worst part in that sticky affair. The CIA was. The CIA was investigating me and the SAR investigators from GreenQuest and Customs. The CIA and the FBI investigated everyone who had anything to do with the SAR investigation. White vans and SUVs with dark windows appeared near all of the homes of the SAR investigators. All agents, some of whom were very experienced with surveillance, knew they were being followed, and so did I. I felt that I was being followed everywhere and watched at home, in the supermarket, on the way to work, and for what? Now I was being watched 24/7. It's a terrible sensation to know that you have no privacy and no security. That strange clicking of the phones that wasn't there before, the oh-so-crudely opened mail at home in the office, and the same man I spied in my neighborhood supermarket who was also on the train I took to Washington a week ago. Life can be miserable when you know that someone's always breathing down your neck. The customs agents were questioned, so were the supervisors, so was the U.S. attorney on the SAR case. One of the questions they were all asked was whether they'd leaked material to me. They all kept saying that this was the most preposterous idea. They all said that before I came, none of them had the slightest clue about SAR and 555 Grove Street. They said that there was nothing of value they could give me that I didn't have already, that I was the one who gave them the material, not the other way around. None of the investigated parties has the slightest clue as to the real reason they were being investigated, unquote. Well, I do, and I think I've hinted at it pretty directly in the course of the broadcast, or at least the first half, because this concludes that half. This wraps up side one of For the Record program number 632, update on September 11th and related matters, being recorded on March 30th of 2008. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.